This is the Resurrection of Jesus, Part 2, Historical Reasoning and Evidence. Our objectives are to defend the historical hypothesis that God raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead, and to critique alternative historical hypotheses. If you recall, the historical investigation of ancient sources, the outline we laid out is as follows. We've already done the first Roman numeral documentary source investigation. We've assessed lower and higher criticism concerning the New Testament and found them to be generally reliable, especially concerning Paul, the Synoptics, and John. We've provided an interpretation that gave us a religious context to understand Jesus' claims to be God incarnate and discuss the validity and the logical or coherence of that claim. It is here that we want to create a hypothesis, a historical hypothesis, formulate that hypothesis based on certain historical facts, and then, of course, submit that test to the criterion that we identified from Behe McAuliffe's book, Justifying Historical Descriptions. There have been many critics of the resurrection of Jesus. We could go back starting in 1965 with Hugh Schonfield's work titled The Passover Plot. There he presented the suggestion, which is quite implausible, that Jesus never died on the cross. Instead, he had just swooned away or somewhat fainted away and then was later revived in the tomb, of course coming out and being able to convince his disciples that he had risen from the dead and was the Messiah. Donovan Joyce wrote the Jesus Scrolls. She believed that Jesus was revived by a doctor who was actually planted in the tomb ahead of time. And not too long ago, Barbara Thering, who is a professor at the University of Sydney, Australia, came out with a book that described Jesus as taking snake poison in order to fake his death upon the cross. Later, when he came out of the tomb and lived out the rest of his life, he went on to wed Mary Magdalene and then fell in love with Lydia of Philippi. Of course, these are not considered by the mainstream of New Testament critics to have any historical validity by historians as well as New Testament critics. Nonetheless, they're quite popular books, and the populace is given a picture of Jesus concerning his death and resurrection that is just completely built on fiction, and many take it as being historical truth. John Dominic Crossan of Jesus Seminar fame maintained in a Time article in 1994 that the tales of entombment and resurrection were later day wishful thinking. Instead, Jesus's corpse went the way of all abandoned criminal bodies. It was probably barely covered with dirt, vulnerable to wild dogs that roamed the wasteland of the execution grounds. So here he completely discounts any historicity to the entombment of Jesus and his resurrection. One of my personal favorites is a debate that William Lane Craig did in 1995 with Robert Gavin. Here, Gavin attempted to defend the belief that Jesus actually had an identical twin brother. He even named him Jerome, who was separated from Jesus at birth, but then reappears at his crucifixion. He steals the body of Jesus and then goes forth trying to convince his disciples that he is Jesus risen from the dead with a messianic mission. Many other scenarios have been put forth that clearly stretch the imagination and take us way far from historical fact, or the bedrock of historical fact we'll be examining in just a little bit. These explanations might make Time magazine or even an evening documentary on ABC, but none of them really find any serious consideration among mainstream New Testament critics or even historical scholars for that matter. This is simply because there is little to no corroborating historical evidence and much that controverts these theories. In what follows, I will present an analysis of a historical description containing the Christian claim of resurrection. Then I will suggest a hypothesis and draw support from observational statements. I'm relying much on the work of William Lane Craig, so I should give him credit but I find his argument to be one of the most persuasive that I've ever heard and want you to be exposed to it. And I find his work on the resurrection of Jesus and his books and also his debates to be very well done and very convincing. And so I will follow his lead. First of all, I've already exposed you to this, but let me remind you, this is C. Behan McAuliffe's book, Justifying Historical Descriptions, in which he puts forth and provides for us what he thinks are the most important criterion for actually justifying any historical description. And it would seem that if we're going to justify something like the resurrection of Jesus, that we should use his criterion to see if at all we actually fit it in terms of the New Testament. The six areas that he puts forth is the explanatory scope, explanatory power, the plausibility, that it is not ad hoc or contrived, that it agrees with contemporary or accepted beliefs of today, and it far exceeds any other rival theories in meeting the five conditions just put forward. Virtually every critical New Testament scholar across the theological spectrum in the last 100 years has accepted this 1 Corinthians as a genuine letter authored by the Apostle Paul. Many understand that this is an early Christian pre-Pauline creed contained in 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 5a. Now, the foremost New Testament scholar on this would be Joachim Jeremias. Some of the things that he presents concerning this are as follows. First, Paul's words, delivered and received, I delivered, I received, are technical terms for passing on tradition. Second, a number of non-Pauline phrases, for example, for our sins, according to the scriptures, he has been raised, the third day, he was seen in the 12. These are not typical Pauline words or phrases, which would seem to indicate that the source is not Pauline. Third, the stanzas are in a stylized parallel form that are indicated by the use of that or hati in Greek, which is grammatically unnecessary. Fourth, it contains hints of an early Semitic origin because it uses, instead of the Greek for Peter, it uses the Aramaic Cephas. And fifth, most conclude that since Paul wrote 1 Corinthians around 55 AD, the creed must be dated from the mid-30s. To just 3 to 8 years after Jesus' crucifixion. Now, several critic historians have noted the reliability of this text. Some of them, as I mentioned before, Joachim Jeremias, Hans von Copenhausen, A.M. Hunter, Ernst Lichtenstein, Ernst Balmer, Karl Heinrich, and Hans Grass are all scholars that have recognized the very early nature of this creed and its reliability. The context, however, is perhaps the most revealing and the best argument that it is a pre-Pauline formula. The first two elements are not really necessary to Paul's further argumentation concerning the resurrection. Hence, the fact that this is cited, that they are cited, would seem to be a strong indication that it is to be taken together as a unit and is not original to Paul, but was something that he received and has now delivered, and he is repeating the creed which has come down to him. Now, I think from this text, there are four very important historical facts that emerge. First of all, Jesus died. He was buried. The disciples believed that Jesus appeared to them after his death, and this was a central element to the early church's message. Based on these four historical facts, I suggest the following hypothesis adequately explains them better than any other hypothesis that is put forth to explain the same material. The hypothesis is that the reports about God raising Jesus from the dead are justifiable and true. And I'll support this with four observational statements. After his crucifixion, Jesus was buried by Joseph of Arimathea in a then-known tomb. On the Sunday following the crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was found empty. On multiple occasions and under various circumstances, different individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive from the dead. And four, The original disciples believed that God raised Jesus from the dead. After his crucifixion, Jesus was buried by Joseph of Arimathea in a then-known tomb. The account of Joseph of Arimathea is a very probable account. The reason for that is that most scholars agree that Joseph is likely the individual that buried Jesus. This is because it is very improbable that the early Christians invented an individual that is a member of Sanhedrin whose council members would have been very well known in the time. This would easily have been refuted if it wasn't true. Second, the account is in Mark 15:43, and Mark is considered by most New Testament scholars to be very early, and hence this makes the account even older, that contains likely no legendary development associated with it. The list of women witnesses is also very probable. How could persons well known in the early Christian fellowship be named as witnesses if it is known that they were not? If they are fictitious, how could the fellowship accept Mark's account of them? Considering the very low status that women had in this society, it is really quite surprising that they are named at all, for women in this society could not have served as witnesses in a court of law. And fourth, there are no other burial stories. If the account of Joseph's burial of Jesus is wrong, it's quite remarkable that there are no other stories that exist to refute this account. On the Sunday following the crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was found empty. The empty tomb is supported by simple reasoning that is applied to the historical setting. The disciples could not have believed in the resurrection of Jesus without an empty tomb. For a first century Jew, a resurrection would automatically entail an empty tomb. This would either be explained in terms of a resuscitation or in terms of a glorified body. There was no concept in his day that a resurrection could take place with the body still in the tomb. Second, the origin of the church in Jerusalem requires an empty tomb. The locus of the early church was in Jerusalem. This is where Christianity began. When the disciples first started preaching and people responded, the Jewish authorities must have been helpless because the tomb must have been empty. Time would not be a factor. Whenever the disciples returned from Galilee to Jerusalem, the tomb must have been emptied for their message to be believed. The very fact that Christianity could be started in the very place where Jesus was executed and buried is strong evidence for the empty tomb. And third, the Jews would have produced the body had the tomb not been empty. Even in the unlikely event that the disciples never checked the tomb, certainly the Jews would have observed the tomb. This would be true not only if he was buried in a well-known grave, but also if he was buried in a common grave for criminals. This is because the freshly dug grave plot could easily have been pointed out to 6 weeks after his burial. And four, the credibility of the burial narrative and the inability of the Jews to exhume or point out the body clearly favors an empty tomb. Matthew's story of the guard at the tomb and the remark that the disciples stole the body would indicate that the enemies of Christianity were involved in an effort to explain away the empty tomb. On multiple occasions and under various circumstances, different individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive from the dead. 1 Corinthians 15:3-8 is a testimony from Paul, who was acquainted with the first disciples and reports that they saw Jesus alive from the dead. 1 Corinthians 15:3-8 is a testimony from Paul, who was acquainted with the first disciples and reports that they saw Jesus alive from the dead. First, the appearance to Peter. The appearance is mentioned in Luke 24:34, but it is here in an old Christian saying, as we pointed out, an old Christian creed. Paul spent 2 weeks with Peter about 6 years after the event, as recorded in Galatians 1:18. Appearance to the 12. This is described by Paul, Luke, and John. Luke and John placed the appearance in Jerusalem on the same day as the appearance to Peter. The appearance to 500 brethren. Most amazing, no other account of this. Possibly this could have taken place in Galilee. Paul must have had personal contact with these people. Some, he claims, are still alive. as if to ask the reader to check it out for himself. The appearance to James. Jesus' brothers did not believe in him during his lifetime. Then all of a sudden, James appears in the Christian fellowship in Acts 12:17. He's considered an apostle in Galatians 2:9, and the head of the church in Jerusalem, according to Acts 21:18. Paul conducted a two-week sojourn in Jerusalem 3 years after his conversion. It's at this time that he likely met with James and could have received this account firsthand, if not sooner. Appearance to all the apostles. This is also likely made reference to in Acts chapter 1. This group may be identical to the 12, or it may be a second group of additional apostle missionaries. And then finally, the appearance to Paul himself, as recorded in Acts 9:1-9. Paul's reference to himself in his letters makes his conversion established beyond doubt. What would change a respected Pharisee, a very well-educated man, a rabbi, who hated and even killed Christians, suddenly give up everything and become a Christian missionary with a life of poverty, suffering, and ultimately finding his doom at martyrdom in Rome? All of this is because of an experience outside of Damascus, as he makes reference to in 1 Corinthians 9:1. Now we might ask here, could the appearances be visions or spiritual, that is, in one's mind only and not in reality? Here we have to acknowledge that some New Testament critics will allow for the fact that disciples did see appearances of Jesus, but most of them would assert that these appearances are visions or something that takes place in the mind only, not something that takes place in the physical world. But Paul clearly implies in the text that the appearances are physical. Paul's experience in Acts chapter 9 is much more than a vision. A vision is a projection in the mind that corresponds to nothing in the real world. A biblical example of this would be Acts 7:54-58. But because others also experienced the light and the voice, which certainly would not have been possible if it was only in Paul's mind. But even if Paul's experience is only a vision, it does not therefore justify the claim that all the other appearances were only visions as well. The fact that Paul's experience happened about 3 years after the others seems to suggest that Paul is defending his experience as being of the same type and quality as the other appearances that are listed. There are a number of features in the Gospels that would only be true for a physical appearance. In fact, Paul draws a contrast between an earthly body and a resurrection body, which he certainly believes Jesus is the first to have. The earthly body is mortal and dominated by the physical, and the resurrection body is immortal and dominated by the spiritual. All the Gospel accounts show physical appearances of Jesus. These are contain instances where Jesus is heard, he is touched, and even eats food with his disciples. Could these appearances fit the category of hallucination? It would seem not, since the theory cannot account for the plurality of separate witnesses, nor the repetition of the appearances and the empty tomb. Even Norman Perrin, who is not a supporter of the historicity of the resurrection, admit, the more we study the traditions with regard to the appearances, the firmer the rock begins to appear upon which they are based. Now, Paul's list alone in 1 Corinthians 15 testifies to the different individuals and groups on different occasions, in different places, and under different circumstances. The suggestion of a chain reaction of hallucinations among the disciples does not alleviate the problems, since neither James nor Paul were in the chain of believing disciples. A hallucination, if true, only explains the post-resurrection appearances. It does nothing for the other historical facts that we've identified, such as the empty tomb, the rolled-away stone, or the inability to produce a body. The original disciples believed that God raised Jesus from the dead. At the crucifixion or death of Jesus, the disciples were defeated. The Jews had no concept of a Messiah that would die and rise. Their idea of a Messiah was someone who would come from the line of David and would overthrow the oppressors of Israel and establish once again the Davidic line of king. According to Jewish law, Jesus' crucifixion demonstrated that he was a heretic and cursed by God. So what other alternatives exist for the belief of the disciples? Well, it is not likely that it is from Greek mystery religions, because there's no concept in the Greek mystery religions of a resurrection that predates Christianity. And I'd have to refer you to Ronald Nash's excellent work on this, The Gospel in the Greeks. And it is also likely not from Jewish influences. The Old Testament belief in the resurrection is mentioned in Isaiah 26, Exodus 37, and Daniel 12. It was always thought to occur at the end of the world. Also, the Jewish resurrection was only a general one. It was not an individual one. There was no Jewish concept of an individual, a one individual who would rise from the dead. And it's also worth noting that the disciples did not call what happened to Jesus a translation, such as that which is considered for Enoch and Elijah, but instead it's a resurrection. It is not likely that Jewish men, given the worldview and religious background, would come to believe in an individual contemporary resurrection all by themselves. Furthermore, it's very unlikely that the disciples were deceived or a myth was invented. As others have noted, the time between the events and the writings of the Gospels is too short to allow for legendary or non-miraculous to miraculous development. Roman historian A.N. Sherwin White remarks that the classical history is usually based on sources that are one or two generations removed from the events. For the time of the New Testament, Paul and the Gospels, even by the most liberal dating, the time is too small. Even two generations is too short to allow the mythical tendency to prevail over a hard historical core of oral tradition. Julius Mueller challenged scholars in the 19th century to show anywhere in history where within 30 years a great series of legends accumulated around a historical person and became fixed in general belief. He has never been answered. Another controlling presence against the development of myth is the geographic proximity of the origin of Christianity and the beliefs concerning the empty tomb. With that of the eyewitnesses. The witnesses listed by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 continued to live and would be able to exercise control on the tradition that developed. An example of this may be the testimony of the women. It is difficult to see how the tradition would arise in the context of the first century, unless, of course, it was true. Fictitious stories could not become widespread as long as the apostles, authorities in the church, were still alive. And finally, the disciples were willing to go to their deaths for the fact of Jesus' resurrection. One might certainly be willing to die for what he knows to be the truth. But it is beyond credulity to assert that all of them would die for what they know to be a lie. And because they were in the position to know what the truth was about Jesus, and because they paid for it with their lives, it is most reasonable to assert that they were telling the truth. In conclusion, let's apply McCullough's criterion for justifying historical description. From the evidence presented to support the observational statements and further examination, I conclude that the answer that God raised Jesus from the dead passes all the tests involved in historical justification, according to C. Behan McCullough's book, Justifying Historical Description. For example, it has great explanatory scope. As William Lane Craig says, it explains why the tomb was found empty, why the disciples saw post-mortem appearances of Jesus, and why the Christian faith came into being. Second, it has great explanatory power. It explains why the body of Jesus was gone, why people repeatedly saw Jesus alive despite his early public execution. It has plausibility. Given the historical context of Jesus' own unparalleled life and claims, the resurrection serves as a divine confirmation of those radical claims. It's not ad hoc, nor is it contrived. It is assumed, and we have demonstrated elsewhere, that God doesn't exist and miracles can't happen, so these are justified in the context of the worldview that's being presented with respect to this historical evidence. And it agrees with accepted beliefs. The hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead does not conflict with the accepted belief that people do not rise naturally from the dead. It is an accepted belief within a theistic worldview that God can raise people from the dead. And finally, it far exceeds rival theories in meeting these five criterion. There are only these options with respect to Jesus. We could say that Jesus was not crucified, but this is highly unlikely and very improbable because of the early reliable sources of 1 Corinthians 15 and Mark that I have relied upon as evidence. Also, the death that Christ suffered agrees with a contemporary understanding of crucifixion. Many studies and medical journals have been written on the process of crucifixion. It is a grueling method that ensures death. So Jesus was crucified. We could say that Jesus is not risen. But this is highly improbable. The apostles, the only options available to us are that the apostles were deceived. But this is improbable since it cannot explain the repetition of the appearances, the separate witnesses, and the empty tomb. Maybe the apostles were deceivers. But this is improbable since they died for its truth and could not have intervened. But this is improbable since they died for its truth and could not have invented or attached their story to such notable figures as Joseph of Arimathea and Saul, an enemy of the faith. Further, they could not have started Christianity in such close proximity to events that could easily have been verified. What about the apostles being myth makers? Well, this again is very improbable since there's not enough time for the myths to have developed and erase a solid historical core of what happened. So we're left with Jesus risen, and this is very probable given the existence of God, the early reliable sources that we've identified, especially 1 Corinthians 15 and Mark, and the explanatory scope that we've identified in items 1 through 5. Hence, the historical hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead is justifiable and true. In reviewing our outline of apologetics, we've established the specific reliability of the historical accounts concerning Jesus of Nazareth's claim to be both God and human. And here, we've particularly established the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth from the dead, establishing point number 7, that the claim that God raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead is historically justifiable.